WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In his new book, Mark Bittman writes that we are faced with a choice when it comes to fixing our food system and making it sustainable for future generations. The choice, he writes, is not to change our way of life or simply muddle along as we always have. The choice is to change the system or suffer catastrophe. In Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food, From Sustainable to Suicidal, Mark Bittman traces the origins and then the subsequent perversion of agriculture, which has led to our current system, which he identifies as being simply unsustainable. Vice President Al Gore called Animal Vegetable Junk a must-read for policymakers, activists, and concerned citizens looking to better understand our food system and how we can fix it. Mark Bittman joins me now. Welcome back to All of It, Mark.
Great to be here, Allison. Nice to talk, as always.
So what did you see or what did you experience that made you want to tackle this subject now?
Well, in a way, the answer to that question is personal because the subject has been glaring for, let's say, a couple of decades. I mean, many years anyway. And I originally thought that by addressing this journalistically, that is an article or two at a time, I could help people, I could sort of create a mosaic that would help people understand how flawed the food system was and how important it was to move forward in changing things. But that didn't work. So in 2015, I left the Times and decided that I would try to do it this way, that is, put everything in one place, or as much as would fit and I had time for, and do it the old-fashioned book way. So here's the book.
How did you know where to start on such a big subject?
You know, I originally started at the beginning of time because, I don't know, maybe that was a lack of imagination. but the book starts when our ancestors came out of the trees, because that's when our relationship with food really, really began to change. And then, of course, there's a discussion of fire and cooking. But the real beginning of the story is quite recent in terms of even human time, and especially, obviously, in geological time. But the real beginning is 10,000 years ago when what is sometimes called the agricultural revolution happened.
So that's when humans started to intentionally grow plants and raise animals, which seems two very straightforward acts. When do things start to become compromised?
Well, immediately, really. I mean, it does seem brilliant, and maybe it is. I mean, from the perspective of species survival, there were maybe 5 million humans at that time, and now there are 7 billion. So we've done a good job of reproducing ourselves and surviving. So from that perspective, it was a great decision. But the quality of individual lives, this is all archaeological evidence, there's no written record, obviously, but the quality of individual lives declined when we began doing agriculture. Lifespans became shorter, people became less healthy, civilization happened, which has its good and its bad aspects, as we know. But so with it came hierarchy and stratification and gender and other biases and war.
You walk us through certain key moments in agriculture, and I pulled out a few I wanted to ask you about. In a chapter titled Creating Famine, you write about the history of colonization and the direct link between colonizers and the orchestration of famine. Can you share an example of this?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about colonizers, then the easiest one is the United Kingdom. And the United Kingdom was interested in keeping its colonies, and its Ireland wasn't a colony, but it was a near colony. It was interested in, you know, we all learned in high school that colonization was about natural resources, but natural resources includes land and labor. And India, for example, had a thriving economy and was among the world's leading industrial producers of cotton goods when it was colonized by Britain. But soon thereafter, its GDP plummeted. It was exporting much of its cotton to the UK, but only when the UK wanted it. And the same was true with edible crops. And so through a variety of circumstances, it wasn't as if the UK, I wouldn't accuse the UK or Great Britain at that time of engineering famine, but they did not in Ireland and India and elsewhere, they did not alleviate famine. They thought that there were beneficial aspects for them of having people starving in other countries, in countries that they were occupying.
You cover the history of American farming in chapter 5. It's called The American Way of Farming. And you write, from the late 19th century through most of the 20th century, no country was better at raising cheap food than the United States. What was different about the American way of farming?
We really did invent factory farming. And there's a wonderful book whose author's name is escaping me. I'm sorry, but it's called Every Farm a Factory. And if you look at what industrialization means, the aspects that define something as an industrial way of producing, farms met all of those qualifications by the late 19th and certainly early 20th century. We're talking about replaceable workers and exchangeable parts and using current technology and producing on a mass scale, producing only one product at a time, and so on. The farm became a factory, and Americans became expert at producing previously unimaginable quantities of several different crops. The problem was that those crops weren't being raised to feed people. They were being raised to make money with the assumption that people would share in those profits and be able to buy food on the open market. And this is kind of the fundamental principle behind what we now call neoliberalism, but also neocolonialism, the idea that everybody should raise what they're best at raising in such quantity that they can make enough money to buy food on the open market. And that works sometimes, but it certainly doesn't work all the time. And there are dozens of examples of it working to the detriment of small farmers all over the world.
My guest is Mark Bittman. His book is called Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Before we leave American farming, you really can't talk about farming and crops in America without discussing slavery. How does the stain of slavery still affect food production today?
You know, that's a good question. I talked about that a little bit in a column in the Times last week. Mm-hmm. I want to say before I answer the question, if I forget it, maybe you can ask me again. But I want to say that there are really, really powerful arguments that slavery built the economy of the United States, not only in the 19th century, but that its ramifications carried over well into the 20th century, that the reason that the United States is an economic powerhouse has a lot to do with slavery. So I don't know. I just feel the need to get that said, so for what it's worth. So agriculturally, the South obviously had a slavery-based economy. And after the end of slavery, the Jim Crow laws and so on kind of reestablished the subjugation of many African Americans and also chased many African Americans out of the South, off the land, up to the North. And so as a consequence, we have very, very few black farmers in the United States these days, 98%, and that's probably an underestimate, but if it's close to 100 as you need to be, 98% of land is held by white people. The number of black farmers has fallen by 95% in the last 100 years or so. And as a result, we had an opportunity to take America's best and most experienced farmers, or at least the South's best and most experienced farmers, and encourage them to do good farming where they lived. And instead, we discouraged that while we were, and when I say we, I mean the government, USDA, big business, and so on, while we were essentially dismantling the small family farm, the thing that's in our minds when we think of what a farm looks like, barely exists now, and it, as little as it exists for white people, it exists even less for black farmers.
You mentioned the government, and I found this interesting when you were writing about the Dust Bowl. I'm going to read this passage and then we can talk about it. You write, "The Dust Bowl, like most tragedies of modern agriculture, was neither an act of God nor inevitable. Rather, it was a direct result of the actions of settlers and the government programs that directed them." What programs are you talking about?
Look, I mean, this is in a way the same as the famine question. Of course, there are environmental factors. The Dust Bowl was a result of a weird climate period of calm winds and abundant rains in the South Plains. That was unusual. And when the weather reverted to its normal arid, hot, or arid, windy conditions, soil was lost. Now, why was the soil lost? The soil was lost because those plains had been covered with buffalo and buffalo grass for literally thousands of years. And that was a sustainable system. The buffalo ate the grass, they fertilized the grass set down deep, deep roots to protect the soil from that dry, windy climate. And in the course of maybe 20 years, shortly after the invention of the gasoline-powered tractor, the government encouraged the sale and giveaway of land to people who would go clear that. First, kill the buffalo, but that had been done already. But clear that land of the buffalo grass and start planting, at that time, mostly wheat. So you took a sustainable environment. Mm-hmm. You killed or removed the indigenous inhabitants. You killed the indigenous animals. You removed the indigenous plants. And what was left was an ecosystem that was not only not sustainable, but was subject to it was vulnerable to what turned out to be the normal climate. And as a result, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of farmers had to move, starved, got sick, et cetera. And the landscape was barren for years and years after that.
One of the themes that comes through the book very clear is how interconnected everything is. If you talk about agriculture, you talk about environment, animal welfare, you have to talk about welfare of food workers. You write about how you can't talk about food workers without talking about income inequality. And then you have to talk about racism and integration. And everything is so very much interconnected, intersectional, if you will. How have we seen this play out over the past year with the pandemic? Because early on, there were all these disruptions with the food supply.
Thank you for that question. It was really very well put, by the way. I think we're seeing people, so much about the pandemic is anecdotal, right? I mean, I know there's reporting on it every day, but it's too soon to know what we're emerging from, it's interesting from a dispassionate perspective. We just don't know what we just lived through. But part of what we lived through was a failure, I think ultimately a kind of minor failure, but an indicative failure of the big food system, the problem with always shipping everything 3,000 miles, 5,000 miles, 10,000 miles, and an increase in reliance on the part of many people on their regional food systems to the extent that they exist. CSAs are all sold out into past this summer, even into next summer. Farmers markets are booming, and they were booming at the height of pandemic. People were standing 6 and 10 feet apart on lines in the dead of winter to buy good local food. And I think we've learned something from that. I also think, you know, the election, it's impossible to ignore the change in the administration and the fact that the COVID Relief Act had two really important food-related parts of it. One was integration of the Justice for Black Farmers Act, which succeeded, and the other was the $15 minimum wage, which ultimately failed. But the fact that both of those things were brought up as COVID relief, I think is terrific and a sign of real progress. That's encouraging.
The name of the book is Animal, Vegetable, Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. It's by Mark Bittman, who's my guest this hour. So usually things don't change because someone is benefiting from the status quo. It works for someone. Currently, who does our food system work for?
Well, you can, you know, if we're talking about globally, let's pretend there are 6 million of us because it makes the math so much more pleasant. A third of us eat really, really well. And it's impossible to argue that the food system doesn't work pretty well for people with money. Although even we relatively wealthy and wealthy people will suffer the impact of climate change, of animal abuse, of worker abuse, and so on, which the food system is well known for. Then there's a third of the population or so that is getting enough calories, but they're often the wrong kind of calories, and that's the junk discussion of the book, the public health crisis that results from the overconsumption of junk food. And then a third of the world is suffering from traditional undernourishment, not getting enough calories or not getting enough nutrients. So that's kind of the breakdown of that. The real beneficiaries, of course, and I think I'm going to have to preach for a second here, the real beneficiaries are the multinational corporations who run the food system. And I want to say that one of the key questions in the book, and something that's emerged in my life or has emerged in my mind as a result of the book being a seed in my thinking, is that the real question about food is, what is food for? Why do we have a food system? Why do we need food? And the answers are pretty clear. The answers are, we want to grow, or we should be growing, affordable, nutritious food for as many people as possible. You might want to add, minimize environmental impact, treat workers well, and so on. But it's kind of fundamental. But the answer from the de facto answer is, the food system exists to enrich the people who own it. And the people who own it are a relatively small number, hundreds or perhaps thousands of corporations and huge farmers that are the primary beneficiaries of the way the food system is organized right now.
What could motivate the people who are benefiting from this, even though it might be hurting others? What could and how could they be motivated to make a change?
I mean, this is your answer to this is as good as mine, and the only, I'm a fan of, the government exists to protect people. That was the original idea, and as that idea matured, it became more specifically that government exists to protect people from business. Businesses do what's most profitable. The food system is working really well for food businesses right now. What's going to motivate them? Yes, to some extent, market change, that is demand, but much more important, what's going to motivate them are enforcing existing regulations and creating new regulations that move us toward having a more sustainable food system, which really means changing the way that we grow food. And that begins with, what are we planting? What do we want to grow? Because it doesn't benefit most of us to grow primarily corn and soybeans. And yet that's what's most profitable right now.
The book is called Animal, Vegetable, Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. It is by Mark Bittman. Mark, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's great to be here, Allison. Thanks again for having me.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.